I'm Jerry Minocalk.
Hey, Jerry.
And I'm really excited that asked Bill, and Bill said yes. It's not really a surprise because I don't think Bill has ever said no to anything that I'm aware of. And he speaks a lot. He's probably the force behind the Atlanta Men's Workshop and has been for like 25 years or something ridiculous like that. But not as a speaker that I'm so excited, but as a person, a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as an example of what we do. We talk a lot of great stuff. We may think a lot of great stuff, but it's really what our feet do. And if you watch Bill, the guy works. The guy is behind the scenes, in front of the scenes, but he just doesn't stop. You know, he texted me earlier in the week. He said, "You mind if I bring a chair?" And I'm like, "Okay." You know, and he said, "Well, I got clots, and I'm worried about, you know, them settling in, whatever. It's probably better if I sit." And I asked him, so I said, "Can you sit on a bar stool?" So we brought a bar stool for him tonight. But you, it'd be very easy, you know, if you're in intensive care earlier in the week or before the rock, and go, "You know what, I need to lay low. I need to lay off my responsibilities and just take it easy." And that's not Bill. I'm really proud to call him a friend. We'll look forward to hearing you, Bill. All right.
Has a familiar feel to it.
Yeah.
My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight, and that's the most important thing that I can share from this bar stool tonight, that it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender, loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have awakened for the last 12,781 mornings without a hangover. Now, I don't want you sitting here the next hour trying to figure that out. My sobriety date is July 26, 1982. And being sober for 35 years, I can assure you that it impresses me way, way more than it does you. I am tonight here to be able to tell you that I am a walking, talking, breathing miracle. And there's going to be more about that a little bit later. This is, I don't know, the second or third time that I've spoken to this group. And I was getting dressed tonight and thinking about being invited back. I mean, there was a time when I was not invited back anywhere. But I got to thinking about it, and I asked my wife, "Honey, how many really, truly great AA speakers do you think there are?" She looked at me for a few seconds and kind of shook her head, and she said, "I don't know, but there's one less than you think." Nothing like a good alcoholic wife to give you a dose of humility when you need it. Speaking of that, I had a unique experience. About 20 years ago, I got one of the greatest honors I've ever had in my life. I was asked to speak at Saturday night at Founders Day in Akron. And my wife and a sponsee and some other friends, we flew up to Akron. And I really didn't fully comprehend what I was in store for. But we got into this arena, and there were 18,000 people in there. And my heart's fluttering. And we go back outside, and we're kind of stretched out on the lawn in front of that big arena on Akron University campus. And as the people piled into the arena by the hundreds, I'm looking at them and watching them and saying, "Gee, man, these people are all coming to hear me tonight. Man, you have arrived. This is it." And just as my ego hit its peak, a little bird flew over and pooped on my shoulder. And I just looked up and said, "Thank you." My first AA meeting that I attended was not in 1982. It was about 4 or 5 years before that. A friend of mine had invited me to go to an AA meeting with him. And he was a good friend, so I wanted to be supportive and go with him. Found out he had other motives for wanting me to go, but We got there, and they read all this stuff at the beginning of the meeting. I didn't understand any of it. And I kept leaning over, what are they doing? What is that? Who's this? What's... And people got up and said things. The first thing they did, got up and said, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him or her. And then they would talk about things that I wouldn't have talked about to my best buddy, much less in a crowded room. Then finally, it looked like the meeting was coming to an end, and they called this woman up to the front of the room. Her name was Mary. And when Mary got up and started at the front of the room, people started whooping and hollering and clapping hands and just having a fit. And I said, what in the heck is this about? He said, oh, this is Mary's 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me. Then this guy hugged her and gave her something and put it into her hand, and everybody whooped and hollered about that. And I said, what did he give her? He said, he gave her a poker chip. I went, oh, okay. Then they brought out this little cake and had a candle on it, and they gave her the cake, and everybody sang a song, happy birthday. And my friend turned to me and said, Bill, if you won't drink for a year, we'll do that for you. I said, let me get this straight. If I won't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake. I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. I came into AA reasonably young man. I was 39 years old, same age as Bill W. when he got sober. Been around here 35 years now, and I'm an old man. And I'm 74 years old. And believe it or not, that's the oldest I've ever been. And when I hit 35, I looked back at the changes that took place in my life, some of them very significant. It's been over 35 years since I got into a fist fight with a parking meter. It's been over 35 years since I brushed my teeth with Preparation H. Yo. It's been over 35 years since I pulled up to a sidewalk mailbox and ordered a Big Mac and fries. And it's been over 35 years since I drove into the wrong end of a car wash. I don't know what that woman was hollering about. I was just as surprised to see her as she was to see me. 35 years, in many ways, has flown by. In the last couple of days, I've thought about it, and my talk tonight's going to be a little bit different from what I usually do when I go somewhere to speak. Because I've had a couple of weeks, some life-changing events. 2 weeks ago today, I was in Kennerstone Hospital in intensive care. I had gone to my doctor and said I had some bronchitis and I had some tightness in my chest. And she said, took one look at me and said, you don't look right. There's something wrong. I said, no, it's just some bronchitis. Give me some antibiotics or something. She said, nope. And she reached down, picked up her cell phone. She called 911. And the next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance headed to North Fulton Hospital. They checked my heart and said my heart was okay. Then they did a CT scan of my lungs and said, you have a very large number of blood clots in both lungs. And you've got two massive blood clots in your right leg. My leg was swollen, but I didn't think anything about that. North Fulton said they weren't equipped to deal with that situation that I had. So they wanted to send me to Kennerstone Hospital in a helicopter, and I said, no way, I ain't going in no helicopter. So they gave me an ambulance ride in this special ambulance. I don't know what was special about it except the price, probably. and slapped me in intensive care and started massive blood thinners, and I don't know, I had four or five IVs. I think they ran out of places to put them. And excuse me, I was in there for 4 days. And the pulmonologist and the cardiologist came into my room together, and said you were a walking time bomb. He said, with the location of those clots and the degree of them that are there, we have agreed that you probably had maybe 3 to 4 weeks before one of them headed to your brain, and you'd have a massive stroke, and that would be all she wrote. In other words, you had about 3 weeks to live. And then they said, your being alive today is nothing short of a miracle. And they thought I was a little crazy when I started laughing. And I said, fellas, I've been a miracle for 35 years. What? And I told them who I was and what I was about. And there was a little physician's assistant that was in there with them making notes. And she looked down and smiled and looked at me and she said, I've got 5 years. And needless to say, she took good care of me. To be a miracle again is an awesome thing to me. And as I look back over the last 35 years, so many things have happened. You know, we say in these rooms, don't quit before the miracle happens. I say it a little differently. I say don't quit before the first miracle happens. Because they keep happening, and they keep happening, and they keep happening. They never stop. I have 35 years. Next week, my sponsor will celebrate 59 years of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor, Clancy, will tell you his miracles have never stopped. And he's pretty sure they never will, and so am I. When we come into this fellowship and we pick up this virtually worthless little piece of plastic, we begin a journey, but we also are the seed of a miracle. I'm very grateful for the fact that when I came into AA up at 8111 one Monday evening, that I had a gift that I didn't know I had, and that was the gift of desperation. I was desperate because I knew if this thing called AA didn't work, I was a dead man. My doctors had already told me that's the direction I was heading in. My liver was a mess. I was pale. All kinds of other ailments. And he said, you know, if you don't quit this, you're going to die. And I tried everything under the sun. I tried religion. I tried self-help. Tapes. There weren't any CDs back then. But listen to all these motivational tapes. Read books like I'm Okay and You're Not and Neither's Anybody Else. And nothing ever did anything. Of course, you know, rigorous honesty makes me admit that some of those might have helped if I'd ever finished anything. Because I'd get bored with anything like that and I'd throw it aside. Ah, it's just a piece of crap. So I don't know if it worked or not. I had a young man a couple of months ago in a meeting who had been back out, and he came back in. He couldn't decide what he was going to do, whether he was going to stay, where he was going to go. He said, the truth of the matter is, I just don't think AA works for me. And I said, well, when did you finish doing the 12th step? He said, well, I didn't. I said, how far did you get? Well, I got through the third one. And I looked at him, I said, son, let me tell you something. You're not qualified to say AA doesn't work if you haven't done the steps. Only when you finish the steps are you qualified to say it doesn't work. That's like getting a prescription from a doctor. Like right now, I'm on blood thinners that they're real, real proud of. They're over $500 for a month's supply, and I've got 4 months to go on it. But it's like me saying, well, I took 10 of those pills, and I've still got blood clots, and it ain't working. I've got to do the deal. And I've got to do the deal because the blood clots are still there, but they are smaller, and the what do you call it? Not a CAT scan, something else I had yesterday. Ultrasound. And they said the clots are still there. They are significantly smaller, and there are none of them in the main veins of my body, which gives me a lot of relief. But if you don't do the deal, you can't complain, and you can't say it doesn't work. There are a lot of the miracles that have occurred for me over the years that I know I've missed them. There were times in my sobriety when I've gotten cocky. I've gotten where I take the wonderful things happening in my life for granted and go, that's good, glad that happened. And I have to look back in retrospect and go, no, that didn't just happen. That was another miracle. A lot of people call them coincidences. I like the word coincidence because my definition of it is coincidence, that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And I've had a lot of those in my life. When I realized that 2 weeks ago, I was at death's door, and I am very grateful for the fact that death blinked. I don't know how many of you read the 24-hour book as part of your meditation. I do, and it's important to me. And I just want to read you yesterday's meditation, or part of the meditation. Do I realize that I do not know how much time I have left? It may be later than I think. Am I going to do the things that I know I should do before my time runs out? By the way, what is my purpose for the rest of my life? Do I realize that all I have to make up for is my past life? Do I know that I am living on borrowed time and that I would not have even this much time left without AA and the grace of God? Am I going to make what time I have left count for AA? Very timely for me yesterday. And it's something I take seriously. And I have, for most of my sobriety, tried to do what I can do on a daily basis to repay the debt that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's a weird thing about repaying that debt. The more you give back to AA, you get twice as much in return. And at the end of any given day, you're deeper in debt, but richer. And it never fails. Jerry mentioned that I'm active with the Atlanta Men's Workshop. My first sponsor, a man named Doc Crandall, started the Atlanta Men's Workshop in 1982 in February. I missed the first rock. I was busy finishing up my story. And he dragged me to my first Atlanta Men's Workshop, kicking and screaming, in August of 1982. I could not think of one reason in this world I want to go out in the woods with a bunch of men and spend a weekend miles from anywhere at Rock Eagle. And I said, I'll go once, but I ain't going back. Well, last week was my 71st one out of the 72 that have been held. I've never missed one since then. In 1985, when my sponsor Doc tragically died, his wife walked in with a card file and a checkbook and said, "It's up to you." And I went in absolute panic mode. "I can't do this." And she said, "Yes, you can. Surround yourself with good people." And that's what I've done. I've surrounded myself with good people who are dedicated to the Rock and to men in recovery. And over the years, it grew from about 65 men to now we sell out every single Rock at 400 men. And it's an awesomely powerful weekend, as Jerry can tell you. Any of you other guys ever been? I urge you to go. Almost anyone who goes will tell you it is life-changing. On Sunday morning, we close with the Lord's Prayer and with a playing of Amazing Grace. And to look out at that crowd of 400 men, half of them there for the first time, didn't have a clue where they were going. And they're looking around on Friday like a deer in the headlights, going, "What in the hell is this?" And on Sunday morning, those same guys are standing in a circle of 400 men, tears streaming down their face, saying, "Wow, this is awesome." And I always tell any man that goes, "You go once, and I'll get you back." End of commercial. But I love being a miracle. But I almost equally love seeing other miracles unfold that I've been fortunate enough to sponsor. And I've sponsored a lot of men through the years. I wish I could tell you they all stayed sober. They didn't. I had one 17-year-old kid that came to me and asked me to be his sponsor, and I said, he was like kind of a long-haired, hippie-looking little guy. And I said, "I don't think so. You need to get somebody younger." He came back the next day and said, "I looked around. I don't want anybody else. I want you." Third time, I finally said, "All right, okay. Did a little checking on him. This kid had been kicked out of Dunwoody High School. He had been virtually disowned by both of his grandmothers, who said, "He's the black sheep of the family. He's never going to amount to anything. You're wasting your time." Juvenile court judge said, "I think this young man is incorrigible, and I'm sure I have not seen the last of him." But you see, this kid had that gift I had of desperation. And to make a long story very short, next week I will give him his 31-year chip. And he has stayed sober. And he sponsors a bunch of guys. He is active in his own group. And he loves Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a bunch of those. I've had one that was a college dropout. Decided he didn't even want to go to college. And he came into AA and began to set some goals for himself. He went to the University of Georgia and got a law degree. Works for a very prestigious law firm here in Atlanta. And he's in North Carolina this week trying a very, very big case. And when I talked to him last night, he said it's looking good. He's dedicated to Alcoholics Anonymous. He's dedicated to his profession. And he's grateful to be a miracle. And when somebody looks at me and says, "I don't know if I believe in miracles or not," and I just say, "Open your damned eyes and look around you. You'll see them every single day." Now, I hear people in the program say something that really gets my dander up and my temperature and my blood pressure. When somebody says, "Relapses are no big deal. They're just all a part of getting sober." No, they're not. Relapses are not a part of getting sober. Relapses are a part of keeping from getting sober. I've never given up on anyone I've sponsored. My first sponsor took the words giving up out of my vocabulary. I spoke on the phone today with a young man that I have worked with off and on for 25 years. The longest he has ever put together was 7 months. And he called me today, and he's at the Salvation Army. And he asked me, he said, "Are you giving up on me yet?" I said, "No, Jim, and I won't. As long as you're breathing, there's hope." Because you see, you people didn't give up on me. When I questioned everything about this program, he told me, just keep coming back. My first sponsor told me, he said, I've known nobody in this program that is too dumb or too stupid to get sober. He said, but I have known a few that were just a little too damned smart to get sober. And he said, you know, Bill, I think you're one of those. Pissed me off, and I showed him, which he was banking on. I've buried 4 sponsors in the last 35 years. My first sponsor, Doc, died when he and another man went to try to help a suicidal young man that Doc had been trying to help for several years. And in a motel room, excuse me, they struggled to take a shotgun away from that young man. Someone's hand in it, we don't know who, hit the trigger. Doc caught the blast of the shotgun in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. He gave his life doing what he'd rather do than anything on the face of this earth, and that's to save another drunk. I wish I could say that young man has stayed sober, but he's had periods of sobriety over the years, and we never give up on him either. The second man I had as a sponsor was a man named Hoyt Allison, a very dear, quiet, soft-spoken man. Now, Doc would get in your face, and he would poke me in the nose, which it would infuriate me, which he knew. But the man had an intuition. He knew exactly when what I needed was a kick in the ass and when I needed an arm around the shoulder, and he never missed. Hoyt was quiet. He never raised his voice. But he planted quiet little seeds that were good to take root and to help me point in the right direction. Now, when Hoyt died, I don't encourage anybody to do what I did. Don't do this ever. But for almost a year, I sponsored myself. And it took me almost a year to realize that I had a fool for a sponsor and an even bigger fool for a sponsee. And I ended up through a crazy set of circumstances that would take the rest of the hour to tell you. But I ended up asking a man by the name of Dr. Paul Olliger to be my sponsor. Some of you may recognize the name, but if anybody ever sent you to page 448 or 449, or in the newer big book, page 417, Paul is the man who wrote Acceptance is the Answer to All My Problems Today. And for the last 10 years of his life, he was my sponsor. And he was a little man with tremendous knowledge of the book, very soft-spoken. And I could call him with some grandiose idea of something that I was going to do to reinvent Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the other end of the phone, I would hear him say, "Well now, Bill, that's an interesting concept." And I knew I was dead meat. When Paul died in 2000, I asked a man named Dick Martin to be my sponsor from Bellevue, Nebraska. Dick and his wife, Peggy Martin, are they've spoken all over the world at functions. And Dick was my sponsor for a number of years until 2 years ago when he died of Parkinson's disease. And he was a tough sponsor. Took no bull from me whatsoever. And the day after Dick died, his sponsor, Clancy, called me. I didn't call Clancy. He called me. He said, "Well, you lost a good sponsor yesterday, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah, I did, Clancy. And right now, I don't know what I'm going to do." He said, "You ain't got to do a damn thing. I'm your new sponsor." So Clancy Emerson is my sponsor, but it was no choice of mine. And he is exactly what I need today. I've traveled all over the United States and Canada sharing at AA conferences and had invitations to some other countries. Clancy considers me small potatoes because he does averages over 40 weekends a year all over the world speaking. He's coming up on 59 years sobriety, and he's just turned 90 years old. On my best day, before all this happened to me, I couldn't keep up with that man to save my life. I finally decided he ain't human, but he probably is going to outlive all of us. And he is one of AA's most powerful messenger boys because he tells it like it is. He helped me to realize that mine was a disease of perception. And I had a very warped perception of life and of everything about it. Clancy helped me to see that as hard as I might try to get somebody sober, that on my very best day, I'm just a messenger boy. On my best day, I'm nothing more than a Johnny Appleseed planting a seed with someone that I can hope and I can pray will take root and grow. And I love working with young people in AA because, for one thing, they help me not feel so dang old. And I love watching them get excited about recovery. One of Doc's favorite lines is, "I want all the goodies that AA's got. If all you want to do is quit drinking, you got it." He said, "It ain't good enough for me. I want all the goodies." And I'm just like him. I want all the goodies. And I'm so grateful to a God who has planted those miracles all along my path that have kept me where I belong. A big miracle happened when I was between 4 and 5 months sober. I had to make my first big business trip out of Atlanta up to Washington, D.C. to meet with a congressional committee over some broadcasting legislation. And I had lunch with my sponsor. I picked up a meeting. I went out to the old Hartsfield International Airport, the old one before this one was built. And Doc said, last thing he said to me, he said, "Now remember one thing, son. If you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to drink, you're going to lose. You can't win that argument. You got to brush it aside." I heard it up here, but I didn't hear it in here. That plane had not cleared the ground till that meeting convened in my head. 600 miles from home. Nobody up there knows you're in AA. You could tie one on tonight, and by the time you get home Friday, it'd all be out of your system. Nobody'd know. Yeah, but you'd know. Yeah, but I'm not going to tell. You know. That meeting's just going on, chatter, chatter, chatter. I looked around the plane to see if anybody else was hearing those voices. They weren't. Plane landed, I got in a cab, headed for the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill. I don't know what the other cab driver was saying, because I was still listening in on that meeting, and they were arguing. I stepped out of that cab, bellman took my bag and walked in and took it up to the counter. The minute I walked into that big old atrium lobby, my radar found the bar. I could hear the tinkling of the glasses, the laughter, the music. Bingo, there it is. Took me about 10 minutes to check in, go up to my room, dump the bag, came back downstairs. And I walked over to that bar, and I stood there in the door for probably somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes. And that argument was playing out in my head. You should, you shouldn't. You can get away with it. No, you can't. And I lost. His doctor said I would. And I walked over and I sat down at the bar. And this bartender came up, walked out, stood right in front of me, looked me in the face, and said something really weird. He said, "Hey, buddy, how about a Coke?" "A what?" He said, "How about a Coke?" He said, "I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing, that's what you'd want." He knew that was the pin of Alcoholics Anonymous. He set that Coke down, walked down the bar, talked to two or three other people, poured a couple of more drinks, and he came back. I'm still sitting there staring at that Coke. He said, "You ain't got any business in here, do you?" "No." He said, "Where you belong is two blocks down the street, upstairs over the furniture store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." And I went to that meeting that night. And I did two other things. I walked into that bar, and I thanked an angel in the shape of a bartender for saving my life. And he laughed and he said, "You know, you weren't in as much trouble as you might have thought. When I saw you standing in the door so long, I figured you were looking for somebody. But when you sat down and I saw that pen and I saw the look on your face, I knew what you were up to, and there was no way in hell you were going to get a drink out of me." He said, "There's one thing else you ought to know." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm a temp. I'm only here tonight. I'm not the regular bartender." And the other thing I did is I got down on my knees beside a hotel room bed. And I said, "God, if you've gone to this much trouble to save me today, I will never test you again." And I don't go in bars because I don't belong in bars. I belong in rooms like this with people like you. People who know who and what I am and what I'm all about. I may go to a comedy club to see a comedian. Foxworthy's a friend, and when he's in town, I usually try to go see him. But even in doing that, I take somebody with me in this fellowship. Do I trust myself? Not entirely. Even after 35 years, I'm not going to take a chance. Because, you see, I've got something too precious to lose. And what this fellowship, what you people have given me in the last 35 years. And what I'm about to tell you, I'm not bragging on me, I'm bragging on you. And what you've done for me and what this fellowship has done for me. I've dined twice at the White House. I've dined multiple times at the governor's mansion here in Atlanta. I've been honored by two presidents and three governors of the state of Georgia. And a few years ago, I was inducted into the Georgia Broadcasting Hall of Fame. I owe that to you. I owe it to this fellowship, because without it, without what you gave me and the tools you gave me to try to turn my life around, I would have none of that. I was in a very turbulent marriage the last 10 years or so before I got sober. My wife and I had multiple counselors. One of them counseled us right upstairs in this building. And three different counselors said, we hate to tell you, but we believe your marriage is hopeless. You have no common ground. You're constantly fighting. You can't agree on anything. I think you just need to give it up. But you see, God had other plans. And in December of 1982, on the day when divorce papers were to have been finalized, my wife and I stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier. And we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And this past December, my wife and I celebrated 50 years of happily ever after. Both can tell you tonight, we owe that to you. My daughter had written in her diary on multiple occasions, I wish my daddy was dead, and maybe there'd be some peace in our home. I got to walk her down the aisle when she married. I have a wonderful relationship with my daughter today. She had us at the reception dance to a song, and she wouldn't tell me what we were going to dance to. And when we got up to dance, the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I want to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath on my wings." What a miracle had been worked in this family. They had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the relentless, insidious disease called alcoholism. And yet, meeting by meeting, can you give me a Kleenex or something? Paper towel, anything. Meeting by meeting, sponsor by sponsor, prayer by prayer, step by step, you, God, and AA, thank you, had put this family back together again. I have two strapping grandsons now. They're 13 and 15 years old, and one of them has my name. And I owe you that. In many ways, you've kept my feet to the fire. You've helped me to realize what a precious gift it is that I have. And I'm sorry, but I get very, very angry when I see people take this precious gift that God has given them and throw it back in his face. Because what he gave us was a way out. An old hillbilly drunk named Floyd once said to me that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't, but he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And most of us drunks, in one fashion, form, fashion, or the other, have been to hell. And if it's any worse than what I went through, I don't want any part of it. Hang on to this gift. It is so very precious. Because I believe that God, in his infinite and compassionate wisdom, in 1934, in December when Bill Wilson got sober, or if you prefer, in June of 1935, when Dr. Bob got sober and we have what we call Founders Day, I believe that somewhere in there, God looked down and said, "The lowly alcoholic has suffered for long enough. He's been the outcast of the world for long enough. I've got to give him a way out. And what a way he gave us. He could have said, lock them up in jails and throw away the keys, as many of us were and should have stayed. He could have said, let's put them in colonies like lepers, separated from society, so they can't continue to contaminate the world around them. He could have just said, let them die, as many of us were. But instead, he gave us each other. And with that, he gave us more love and more laughter and more joy and more happiness than most of us could have ever dreamed of in 100 lifetimes. And I think he did one thing more. I think he gave us a one-on-one relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. The condition that I got to go to the Rock this past weekend and never miss one was that the doctor said I have to remain in a wheelchair the entire weekend, and I had to not do anything but just be there. And I went. And I felt an outpouring of love all weekend that I never knew as a drunk. Guys who were taking care of me, pushing a wheelchair all over the place. I'm still going to get to one that did a wheelie with me in the dang thing. You see, I didn't know what unconditional love was until I came to this fellowship. I did not come from a hugging, touchy-feely family. And I looked around at these AA meetings and all this hugging going on. I figured it out real quick. All the men were gay and all the women were on the make. And the main thing was, why did you care? Why do you care about me? What are you reaching out to me for? You don't know me. Of course, I came to find out you knew me better than I knew me. And I learned that you had no motive other than to be there for me and for me to be there for them. None at all. Unconditional love. I never had a clue of what it was until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now at my age, I go around and hug everybody, sometimes two or three times. And they'll just say, oh, don't pay attention to him. He's getting senile. You don't remember who he hugged. It's okay. I wish I had the time to spend all night talking about the miracles not only in my life, but in the lives of the men that I'm so fortunate that God has put into my life. I've come to love men in ways that I never dreamed possible. It's not macho man at all. It's genuine love for another man, another human being, traveling the same road that I'm traveling. And as a sponsor, I'm just another drunk, but I've got a few more miles down that road than the guys that come in today. And I can holler back and say, watch it, you're coming up on a pothole. Be careful, you're straying off the road, get back in the middle. My first sponsor told me when I came into this fellowship, get in the middle of the bed and stay there. Nobody ever fell out of the middle of a bed. And I am grateful that I haven't. I'm grateful that I have one white chip. And it's only by God's grace, that desperation, that I was able to do that. And every year around my birthday, I sit down and I open what I call my miracle book. And I look back over the last year and I write down every miracle I can think of that happened, and I know I missed dozens of them. But I want to keep that as a reminder of where I came from, how I got here, and why I stay. I'm grateful to be alive tonight. If those doctors were wrong, well, I don't know if they were wrong. I did have 2 or 3 weeks to live, perhaps. I'm grateful that my journey is not over. As an old man, I can say, you know, you and I, especially you younger people, you're on the same journey as me. The only difference is most of mine is behind me now. Most of yours is yet to come. And I hope I have some more miles to go. I hope, like Robert Frost said, I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. But I thank God for the journey so far. And I'll pray that he'll let me have a few more miracles before he calls me home. And I want to just end tonight by saying something so simple, but so true, taken right out of my daughter's wedding. Did you ever know that you are my heroes? You're everything I ever searched for and everything that I ever wanted to be. And together, I believe that we can all soar like eagles, because he's the wind beneath our wings. Thank you for listening, and God bless.